and welcome back to Stories from the Ashes, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I am here today with author Rachel Lulich, and she is going to talk with us about her new book coming out from Bandersnatch Press called The Red Door. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, Amber. Thank you for having me.
Well, we usually try to get to know our authors a little bit by asking for their three favorite books or books that have been highly influential in their life. So what do you got?
All right. So as you know, what is your favorite book is the worst question to ask an author.
Truly.
Oh, it's so hard. So I gave this some thought and I decided to go on a theme. So I've picked the three books that have been the most influential to me as a writer.
Nice.
In terms of inspiring me to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So my first book is Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe. When I was in middle school, my brother had a copy of Robinson Crusoe on his shelf, and I read it, and I loved it so much that I read every single word, including, you know, every single word on the front cover, every single word on the back cover. And I encountered this word, abridged, and I asked him, what does abridged mean? And he explained it meant it had been changed from the original, maybe shortened, maybe updated language because it's an older novel. And I was absolutely appalled.
Yes.
So because I loved it so much and I thought I had read Robinson Crusoe.
Right.
So I asked for an unabridged copy for Christmas, which I received from him, and proceeded to start to read it and understand why it was abridged. It remains to this day the most difficult book I've ever read.
Yeah.
But it unlocked so much for me because it taught me, first of all, how to use punctuation of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And it taught me how to, I mean, I swear it increased my reading comprehension exponentially because there's no indentation or quotation marks for dialogue or any of that. So you really have to track with what's going on. So I have very fond memories of reading this book, even though it was a struggle at first. And when I finished it, I felt like I could read absolutely anything, like nothing was going to be difficult after that. So that was
right.
Really cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. I love what you said about the punctuation, because in the homeschooling world, there's Charlotte Mason is a philosophy of homeschooling. One of the things that she really says is she doesn't do grammar early on. And she says that if your kids are reading a lot, they will be naturally learning all of this. And a lot of parents coming into it are really concerned that that won't happen. And it always does. And like you're saying, the more you read, the more you're going to see it and learn it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And learning so much vocabulary and everything as well. My goodness. The next book is called Five Little Peppers and How They Grew by Margaret Sidney. I know. Now talk about underrated. Nobody knows this book. And this book I loved so much. I read it sometime shortly before starting ninth grade. And I loved it so much that in ninth grade, I started writing a novel very much inspired by this, just stylistically and so forth. Nice. It was called The Children of Heron Pond. Aww. And it was my first novel. And I wrote a complete novel
over
the course of ninth and 10th grade. So that's an awesome book. Yeah. And then finally, Lord of the Rings by Tolkien, which I read during my senior year of high school, because it really introduced me to the world of speculative fiction. I had read some sci-fi and fantasy before, but not really knowing that I was reading, you know, a specific genre or whatever, just stuff for school, you know, like Fahrenheit 451 in ninth grade or, you know, The Giver, things like that. But I didn't know that that was sci-fi or that was fantasy or whatever. In fact, I kind of wasn't interested in fantasy or any speculative fiction until I read Lord of the Rings. And then I was like, oh, wow. This is interesting stuff. And I became a much bigger fan of speculative fiction because of that. And again, started to write a novel inspired by that, which unfortunately I didn't finish because then I went to college. And who's got time to write during college?
Yes. That's unfortunate.
So those are my three influential books.
Wonderful. Well, I've decided that I'm going to expand this question set. And do you remember what the first book was that made you cry?
I am racking my brains. I was never much of a crier growing up. It was probably either one of the Thoroughbred book series novels, because mm-hmm. that had to deal with horses, which I love, and like hard stuff happened in some of them, or it was something later, like I don't know. I'm much more prone to tear up at books now than I was growing up. I would say, yeah, I'm not sure, to be quite honest. Oh, possibly Stone Fox. That book by, I think, John Reynolds Gardner really made an impact on me as a kid. I think I read it for the first time in first grade. At school, there was like, you know, a little bookcase with free reading books on it. And yeah, I had never read anything like that before that has, you know, all that gravity to it. And I don't know if I cried or not, but I'm going to say I felt like crying. How about that?
Yeah.
That's the best I've got for that one.
Yeah. I became a regular crier over books in high school. But before that, I'm pretty sure I cried during Understood Betsy when I thought she was going to have to go back to the first aunt. And I was like, no, but she's so good on the farm.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
And then we had an episode recently where I shared that Stephen J. Carroll's Histories of Earth is my opinion, the series that people haven't read yet and that they should read. Do you have an underappreciated or undermarketed or underread book or series that you're like, I really wish people would be reading this?
Yeah. I would say there's a book called Rifles for Waity by Harold Keith. It's historical fiction, takes place in the Civil War, and I have met so few people who know of its existence, and it's so good. It's so good. Yeah, I read that in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I read that in high school, but not for high school.
Mm-hmm. Right, same. Yeah.
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 It's really good.
That's a good one. I don't hear people like in our community that love vintage books talk about it very often. So that's a great one that I think a lot of people would like to know about. So thank you. But I thought we could talk about how we got here.
All right.
So I was a beta reader for your book, The Red Door. I happened to see you do a cry out for beta readers in another group. And I was like, sure. Like, we just had our fire. We're kind of just trying to find some semblance of normalcy and something enjoyable. This sounds like fun. So you were sending out like a chapter every week or two, or a couple chapters at a time. And I was reading them aloud to the girls, and they were just hooked so fast. And they wanted the whole book. It was a good lesson in patience. Like, you have to be patient as a reader, as the author is patient in the writing system. And so that was really enjoyable. And then the great sadness of my life was that it didn't get published right away. Like, I wanted that immediate gratification, which I'm sure you did too.
Yeah, that would have been great.
where I was like, why you finished it? Come on, let's get it out there. But this is the way it is in the writing world. Like, you don't always find a publisher immediately, and sometimes these projects get shelved for a bit, and then you went on and wrote like a whole nother series of books and self-published them in that time period of waiting to find a publisher. And then I started getting familiar with how Bandersnatch worked, and I saw that they were open for manuscripts, and I was like, Rachel, you need to send them your manuscript. I really want this book published so I can tell my friends.
I know, I think you Facebook messaged me. You were like, hey, have you heard of Bandersnatch? Because they're open for submissions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, and it happened. They loved your book, and I'm so excited. Yeah, so here it comes.
Yeah, basically, it's your fault that the book is coming out.
Yeah,
yay!
That's how Carrie put it. Carrie wrote me, and she was like, "Would you like to write an endorsement for this book? It's pretty much your fault." I was like, "Yes, I will definitely endorse the book that was my fault."
Nice.
That's the easy part of the writing process.
Oh my goodness.
You did all the hard work, but we're so excited that this middle grade fantasy dystopian book is going to be published. It's so hard for me to find dystopian middle grade books that I can 100% recommend with no hesitation. And this is one. And so I'm so excited. And you have a publishing date, yes, right, for when it's going to be available. And what is that?
September 19th is the release date.
Oh, it's coming so fast. So
very soon.
So excited. Yeah. And pre-orders are open now for people that would like to pre-order. You can pre-order the Kindle book on Amazon, or you can pre-order the paperback from Bandersnatch's website. And we will have links to those in the show notes. So where did the idea for The Red Door come from?
The idea for The Red Door actually came from a couple of different places. So the original kernel of the idea came in 2012 when I was in Afghanistan. I was in the Air Force. And during this time, I was stationed at a NATO base in the north called Mazar-e-Sharif. And we had a little section of the base where we lived, me and my colleagues. And by section, I mean like a fenced out area, a fenced out square. And in that fence, it was like a chain link fence covered in this green tarp. And in the middle of the back wall of this area, that fence, was this random red door, which was locked when we didn't have a key. So nobody knew why it was there or what was on the other side or anything. It was tall enough you couldn't see over the fence, you know?
Yeah.
So that's where the initial idea came from. I got the idea for the title first, which is very unusual for me. And perhaps because of that, it took me forever to figure out what the actual story was. but I have a friend of my brother's is a writer, Rabia Gale, and she came up with this interesting idea, which she posted online. And it was just a little story snippet. And it was basically about kids who have sort of sensory overload issues and what, you know, but maybe they have special powers because of that. And that got me thinking, I don't know why, but the idea of something ordinary, like a visual stimulus or something, being this thing that has to be dealt with just really intrigued me. And then it popped into my mind, well, what if people don't dream at night? Like, what if dreams aren't a thing? So that's where I got the idea for the dreaming aspect of the story. So Aster, our main character, is, of course, a dreamer. And if you're found out, you get banished through this red door, mysterious portal in the center of her settlement. And that I think was in 2013 or early 2014 that I had that piece of the puzzle. And then I started developing my ideas for the book. So kind of came from random places, and it just developed from there. And I wrote a couple of different just horrible drivel drafts and, you know, threw all of that away. And then in the summer of 2020, I sort of sat down and thought about, all right, what is this story actually about? What is the character arc, et cetera? And I came up with sort of the actual plot and character arc and everything during that time. So it was a long time coming.
Yeah, that's very cool. First of all, thank you for your service. We appreciate that. And then I love the fact that some of the inspiration from this came from that short story on neurodiverse kids, the sensory processing challenged kids, the overstimulated, because my neurodiverse daughters loved Aster so much. They immediately saw what she was doing in trying to pass as a non-dreamer, trying to not get caught as a dreamer, as masking, as mirroring, as trying to behave in ways that would be acceptable to the other people around her. And she's exhausted. And that's their reality when they go out in public and they're trying to not make social, you know, missteps and do things that people might think are weird or odd. It's exhausting. And so they really appreciated having this strong female who's trying to do what's right and trying to navigate hard situations and trying to make amends for areas where she was wrong in the first place, that she just had so many of the same struggles that they struggle with. And so I really appreciate you writing Aster the way that you did, just for the neurodiverse community that are really going to be blessed by her. Do you base any of your characters on real people?
I didn't base Aster on anybody in particular. And I didn't write her with like neurodiversity in mind per se. I was just thinking, well, how would you need to live your life in this kind of situation? Mm-hmm. And so it's really cool to discover that this is actually something that people can really identify with. I'm like, oh, fantastic. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy to hear that. I think in terms of like basing characters off of real people, I don't base characters off of individuals, but I definitely think I incorporate what I know of people from, you know, the people I interact with and so forth over the years into my characters, certainly. But most of it, honestly, is just trying to put myself in their shoes. You know, how might someone behave in this situation? Well, what about somebody with this personality? Yeah. How might they react to that? That kind of thing. And I think just putting yourself in other people's hypothetical shoes, even fictional character shoes, is my, I think, main method of trying to understand the characters and help them to have their own unique voices and thinking through how they would react to things and what that means for their relationships, etc.
Yeah, I like that. I also appreciated the different ways that pain is handled and the bad guy is very bad and she is not managing her pain at all. And she is the classic, if I'm suffering, everyone around me is going to suffer even more.
Yeah.
And then you have people like Kennedy, who lost her mother to the Red Door when she was much younger. And that's a pain. And then feeling like she had lost her friend group and all of this when that shame had fallen on their family. And then Aster has the pain of fear of discovery and not being able to trust her dad because in her mind he's working for the company that, you know, for the organization that is looking for people like me. This is not going to go well. And so I think that just that stark difference between Eleanor trying to rain pain down on every other person not like her and then Kennedy, who walks in grace and walks in forgiveness. I think it's a beautiful contrast. I feel that there are so many very strong contrasts in the book that don't feel contrived at all. It's just, this is how people are. This is how people process.
What a relief.
Wiping sweat from your brow. Phew, not contrived.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, no, they're not. Because sometimes I feel like the author's forcing them, you know, like those moralistic tales where it's like, this is what you're supposed to take away. I didn't feel like that with any of it. At the end of it, I was just like, these were the strong themes that I was seeing. I was seeing the theme of needing to do the right thing because it needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to do it. And so why not me? Why should I wait and assume someone else will do this if I have the ability to do it myself? I thought that was beautiful too.
Thank you.
Especially because that one is on the back of loving your enemies.
Oh yeah.
Loving your enemies and being willing to suffer for righteousness' sake.
It very much is. Yeah.
And, yeah. And that just made me cry. I cried so much in this book. I lost track. I just thought it was beautiful. Both times I read it, I thought it was beautiful as the beta book. I thought it was beautiful as the ARC copy in its final form. It's just, it's wonderful.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, those on those themes that you mentioned, like seeing themes, but not like contrived stuff that felt forced. I mean, for me, the themes really drive the book, you know, and the character arc. I sort of came up with the themes and the character arc at the same time. And then it's just a matter of figuring out, all right, what needs to happen in these characters' lives to sort of bring them from point A to point B in terms of what needs to change within them, you know? So I think that hopefully helps keep things real. 'Cause there's nothing I mean, forced themes and development and forced exposition are the two things I really hate to read. So I try to avoid those.
Yeah. Well, you did a great job. And I was just going to say with the continuing on the neurodivergent theme, I really loved the very clear showing of like the fear of being truly known and then the relief of being truly known and still loved. And that was just, achingly beautiful as well. I was just like, I love this for Esther, that Aww. She's able to experience this at such a young age. So that was so good. Aww. So how many books have you written at this point?
Both published and unpublished?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. And novels, not other things, or?
Sure. Okay. Not short stories, like books.
Right. Okay. But like, I wrote a play. Do we exclude the play?
Sure. We can include a play.
Okay.
Plays are great.
So book length projects. Let's see here. 7 complete book length projects. Six nice. Of which have been, you know, released to the world or will be.
Right.
Yeah. So not a ton, but I've written a lot.
That's great.
Well, I've written a ton throughout my life. I just had a very bad track record of finishing books until recently.
That's hard.
Yeah. I kind of finally figured out my method and what I need to do to get something written from start to finish. So,
congratulations.
Thank you. It only took 500 years.
So you wrote your first book in 9th grade and then you took a break for college. Yeah. And then did you continue the break through your service? And then you've started again more recently, or were you also writing throughout your 20s? And
I mean, I was writing like poetry and stuff, short mm-hmm. things, mostly poetry.
Yeah.
But I had kind of given up the idea of being a writer. Post-college. And I, you know, just was focusing on other things that were more practical and more like, oh, well, this is something I can do.
Right.
Being a writer is, you know, that's a very nebulous thing. And as anyone who's pursued writing seriously knows, not something you're likely to make money at. So, mm-hmm. and it takes a lot of time, especially if you're talking about writing manuscript length projects. So I really didn't do a ton of writing between college and starting to work on this book at the end of my time in the Air Force. But I got out of the Air Force specifically to pursue writing. So I amazing. Started really seriously writing. I got serious about it and compiled my poetry book and self-published that without really knowing at all what I was doing. And then I used NaNoWriMo in 2014 mm-hmm. or 2015 to attempt a first draft at The Red Door and discovered that system does not work for me mm-hmm. because I wrote 50,000 words, but it was all trash. So yeah, I was still doing a lot of writing, but not novel writing. Novel writing I mostly was attempting in high school and right before college. And then right after I got out of the Air Force. But it's good because I did study screenwriting a little bit and mm-hmm. And I wrote a lot of poetry. And those things, you know, writers typically focus on the discipline that they want to sort of get published in, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't because I had this period of time in which I was like, well, I'm not actually going to be a novelist because that's impossible. Mm-hmm. And I think that was actually beneficial for me because you learn so much about writing when you're studying it from different angles. So like in studying screenwriting, I kind of discovered that dialogue was my best skill as a writer. So I probably should focus on screenwriting and playwriting. And then when you write poetry, you really learn a lot about, you know, how to use language to best effect in, you mm-hmm. know, short spaces and things like that. A lot of writers study journalism to get that. But I never took any journalism classes. That sounded boring to me.
Yeah.
So I got it through writing poetry, got those same lessons. And then, you know, just studying other stuff. It all feeds into your writing. It all does. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and journaling and stuff, all of it feeds into your writing. And, you know, I don't think anything goes wasted. So,
yeah. That's awesome.
I don't remember what the question was. I feel like I got way off track there, but
I don't even think it matters. I think I just asked how many books you'd written. That was a great answer.
You're right. You're right. And I went on a tangent.
Do you have a favorite book that you have written?
I have two favorites that I've written. I love the play that I wrote, and I love The Red Door. Those are so far my two favorites. I love the play that I wrote because I love historical fiction, and it's historical fiction. And I love stuff like that. And I love The Red Door because it's middle grade fiction, and that's my favorite thing to read.
Me too. I think middle grade fiction is highly underrated. There's some really beautiful stories with a lot of heart that can be told in a short amount. I have a very good friend who is an immigrant from Armenia, and she loves to read biographies. She is really interested in the people who have formed the world and the different government systems that are in it. And her rule of thumb is she will not read a biography over 200 pages. She's like, about 180 pages is what I look for in a biography, because in that amount of time, you can know what you need to know about this person. And then anything else is just fluff.
Yeah.
And so that's how I feel about middle grade fiction. Like, in this little book, you can probably get a good full story with a lot of heart.
Yeah.
And you don't have to slog through 500 pages to realize you really didn't like it.
To get to the end and be like, man,
yeah,
that was disappointing. Yeah.
This is where we were going this whole time. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. What do you think makes a good story?
That's a great question. So I personally like adventure stories quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I love when there's an element of adventure, whatever that may be. I don't think that necessarily makes good stories in, you know, principle, but for me, I tend to like stories with at least a little flavor of adventure. But in terms of good stories in principle, I think you've got to have good characters who feel like real people, and who at some point at least you can root for.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's got to be some sort of redemptive quality to the story.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean it has to have a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, and this is one of the things that I look for, is for there to be some sort of redemptive aspect of the story. You know, there's got to be the possibility, at least, of hope and of a good outcome. Yeah. There's got to be, and if it doesn't have a happy ending, there needs to be some element of, you know, they didn't die in vain type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's got to be some hint that, but it was worth it because, you know what I mean? Or, but that's okay because their legacy is going to inspire people down the road or something like that.
Right.
So again, you don't necessarily have to have a happy ending, although I'm a fan of those. But I want there to be some element of hope.
Yeah. No Ecclesiastes books. Vanity, vanity. Everything is vanity.
Yeah. Just, you know, nothing that's just depressing and all depressing and that's it.
Here's what I found.
Did your computer just talk to you?
Sorry, Siri just decided to talk to me. I'm not talking to
you. Hey, Siri, away.
I know. What part of focus? Everything, be quiet for an hour. Did you not understand? But I love stories of hope, because I've shared this before. When I started reading The Lord of the Rings again with my daughter, it hurt physically to start reading it because I was in so much pain emotionally in my life, and I didn't want to add their pain to it. And I knew what was coming. I knew their journey. I was not naive coming into what this experience was going to be. But I decided to focus on their hope. I decided that I would take their hope and make it mine as I sludged through. And it ended up being a beautiful journey. And I feel like around the same time they got through their journey, I got through that season of my journey. And so it was just beautiful to come out on the other side, all of us alive together. And so I think that very often you know, we turn to music for hopeful, uplifting themes. Yeah. We turn to these stories for hopeful, uplifting things. We turn to the Bible for the hope of what is to come and what the end of the story is. And so I do agree with you. I do not enjoy stories that just end in hopeless despair, which I think is what the grimdark books are, where like everybody makes their own morals and does what they want and nothing good. And so that's why we promote hope punk, which is the opposite, where it's a small band of people standing against the darkness saying we can overcome. Like, either way, we're going to die trying, because it's the right thing to do, right? Like, pastors, love your enemies and do what needs to be done.
So. Yeah, hope punk is a genre word I just discovered when somebody used it in, maybe it was you, in their endorsement of The Red Door. And I was like, hope punk? Hope punk? What's that? Yeah. That sounds awesome.
It was me. Yeah.
It was you. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I had not heard that one before. What a great descriptive.
Yeah. Mary introduced us to it on the podcast. She came to talk about gardening and herbs, and she brought that with her. And she was like, you know, or wildcrafting and herbs. And she was like, I just discovered this hope punk theme. And we like started talking about it. I was like, that's it. That's my thing. Like, that's what The Lord of the Rings is. That's what most of my favorite books historically have been, is this hope punk theme of banding together and standing up against the darkness. Yeah. So I really, really did love that about The Red Door, the little band of people willing to stand up against the injustices going on.
Even if it takes some coaxing.
What is your writing process? Do you feel energized when you write? Does it exhaust you and take everything out of you? Do you plot a lot ahead of time or just fly by the seat of your pants?
Yeah. So my writing process that I have discovered through trial and error, I used to think I was a pantser, which means you just fly by the seat of your pants. You just have an idea and you just start writing. But I noticed whenever I did that method, with the one exception of that first novel that I ever wrote, everything else, I never finished it. And it was never good enough to make me want to go back and do rewrites to try to figure it out. So I started doing more pre-planning. So I think of, I love film and television. So I kind of think of writing as a process for me in similar terms to filmmaking. So there's, in filmmaking, you have pre-production, production, and post-production, right?
Yeah.
Pre-production, where they do all the casting and location scouting and so forth. Production, where they actually film the thing, and then post-production, where they edit it all together. So I think of my writing process in the same way. I have pre-writing, writing, and post-writing. And I do a lot of pre-writing work. I have found if I don't take the time to do all that pre-writing work, I just can't get through the story. But I wouldn't necessarily call it plotting, because it's a lot more than that. And I don't do sort of like, I don't outline or anything like that. I don't have, you know, point by point what's going to happen. I have sort of the highlights. So again, I need to figure out the themes, the character arcs. I need to figure out, well, what's motivating these characters? What are they like? What has their life thus far shaped them into? And then from looking at that and where I need them to end up, I usually know the end of the novel before I start writing, and often before I start pre-plotting. So then I'm able to basically just chart a basic course. So I'll say, all right, so I need this, this, and this to happen. And everything in between there, I can develop as I write the draft.
Yeah.
And so I kind of go from highlight to highlight as in terms of thought process as I'm drafting. And if I find that I've got writer's block at some point, usually what that means is that I've somehow gotten off the track I need to be on in order to get to the next highlight. And so I need to stop and think about, all right, where did I get off track and start writing stuff that's irrelevant to where I'm headed?
Yeah.
And I just delete everything after that I wrote, no matter how long it is, even if it's a couple chapters, they're gone now. And I take up my new start point and just think about, all right, what needs to happen for these characters next that can bring them to that next highlight point? And once I figured that out, I start writing again, and it, you know, and then I can proceed and it goes well. So that's kind of my writing process, if that makes sense. And I like to write in terms of, a lot of people do word counts, you know, like, oh, my word count today is 2000 words. I can't operate that way. Word count means nothing to me. Mm-hmm. I write in what I call story chunks. Mm-hmm. So I'll write a chapter or a half chapter at a time, a scene at a time. Mm-hmm. So depending on the structure of the story, I might write, I might be like, oh, by lunch today, I want to write two chapters, or by lunch today, I want to write half a chapter, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think of it in those terms. And I write on my little computer. I've got a little portable computer that I do most of my writing on. Yeah. And if I'm really in the zone and doing a ton of writing and making a ton of progress, I'm probably moving between different spaces. I might spend some time writing at my desk. And then if I get tired of sitting, I might go to the kitchen counter, you know, whatever, go down to a coffee shop, whatever I feel like I need to do to move around a little bit.
And, change of scenery.
And then there's that. Now, exactly, it's very nice. So yeah, The Red Door, the process of writing, it was actually pretty exhilarating because I did the draft in 6 weeks.
Wow.
And I had two of those weeks I didn't write anything at all because I had really, really bad writer's block and I couldn't figure out why. So that was really cool. And I wrote all day, every day for about 4 weeks. And then I took 2 weeks off and then I finished it. I will say I tend to make a mad dash for the ending once I get in like the last quarter of a book. I'm like, I got to get done with this. So usually when I go back to do edits, the ending is what needs the most editing. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I do a lot of editing as I draft, which most writers will tell you you should absolutely not do. But I find if I don't, then I end up with just a horrible draft at the end that I don't have the heart to go back and fix. So I don't remove my editing hat altogether. Some things I won't change as I write. Some things I'll just make a note, oh, I need to fix that. And then I can move on now that I've made that note. But I do some developmental editing as I go just to help me make sure that I'm staying on the right track so that when I finish, I have something worth editing in the post-writing process. And that's that.
It sounds like a great system. So if you are storyboarding all the way through the ending before you start, have you ever reached the end of the book and found that the ending has changed?
Not as yet.
Good.
The specifics of the ending might change, but the basic ending stays the same. So I knew, for example, and when I say ending, I really mean the climax. Mm-hmm. So I knew what was going to happen. I knew that at the end of the book, I wanted Aster to do what she does, to take that on. But I didn't know the details of how that would play out. And you'll recognize from the, if I recall correctly, from the beta draft to the finished book, I changed a fair amount in that ending section. I added a lot of stuff. But the basic event that happens, that culminated event, I'm trying to avoid spoilers, my goodness. I knew Aster needed to do what she does. And I knew that it needed to have the impact on her that it has. But the whole ending scene, you know, that denouement, the stuff that happens after the big event, that I didn't have planned out. I just, you know, that's what seemed like needed to happen after that big climactic moment.
Yes.
And so that's what I wrote.
So, Rachel, is this the only book that we are going to have in this place and world, or do you have another story in you to tell?
I don't currently have another story for this world planned, but I do have, it's funny, I have had this idea for a story for years, and I've sort of worked on different ways to approach it, and nothing's ever worked, and it occurred to me several months ago that maybe that story needs to take place in the Red world. So I do have a couple of ideas, but nothing developed yet. I can't make any
promises. I won't get too excited.
I know. I hate that myself as a reader, but I just, you know, The Red Door is a standalone story, but there's a lot there that could be developed into additional stories.
Yep.
I like stories like that, whether they get developed into additional stories or not.
Yeah.
So me personally, I'm good either way. I don't know how readers will feel about it.
I like it because I feel like it it gives the reader the opportunity to imagine different yeah. things that could happen. But at the same time, they're not on a cliffhanger ending, because that's the thing that I hate the most about living authors is when they write cliffhanger endings, because I'm like one car wreck and I never get to hear the end of this story. And that's super stressful for everyone. I mean, we look at the, what is it? The Wheels of Time series.
Yeah.
And how those readers felt terrible. And if Brandon Sanderson hadn't stepped in and finished that series for them, they would just be 20 books into a series and, and not have the ending. And that's really rough.
Yeah, for sure. I will say if I find a story that wants to be told in this story world, I would mm-hmm. love to write it. So it is on my mind. I am considering it. But I think it would probably be more... So I've got two different ideas. One would be sort of like a sequel. Mm-hmm. And one would be more like a companion novel. Mm-hmm. So, and when I first had that idea, I was like, oh, kind of like the Giver Quartet. They're all in the same story world, but mm-hmm. you don't, you know, they're not...
The same cast.
The same main cast of characters, etc. There's different stuff and even different... like abilities and societies and stuff happening in those books. So the other idea that I mentioned about this other book that I've been thinking about for years, if I pursue that as being part of this story world, it'll be like that.
Yeah.
Connected, but parallel
loosely. Story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I like
so
that.
So we'll see. We'll see.
So was this your first dystopian story?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Yes.
Well done. Well done, Rachel.
Thank you. Thanks. You know, I didn't necessarily set out to write a dystopian story per se. It was just the story that it came to mind. And so there you have it.
Well, you've given some really great insight into your writing process, and we really appreciate that. And I was wondering, do you have any specific advice for young writers who are just getting started, maybe kind of like you were in ninth grade when you did your first novel?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. First of all, don't put too much pressure on yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, The Children of Heron Pond, my beloved first middle grade fiction novel, will never be published because it's just not good enough in terms of just the writing style and the storytelling craft. Writing is something, your own writing style and process is something that will probably take a while for you to fully develop. Yeah. That's okay. That's a good thing. It's very easy to hit that self-publish button today. Mm-hmm. Try to resist that temptation, you know, wait a while. Wait until you have something that is for sure like, hey, I could potentially shop this around for an agent or something like that. You know, nice quality, put out good quality stuff as much as you can once you do that. I would also say, you know, if you're thinking of being a writer, you're probably a big reader. Mm-hmm. If you're not, you might want to consider becoming one. and you know, keep reading. And there's, you know, it's interesting. I was always a voracious reader. I was a big bookworm. I love reading. I'll just gobble stuff up, but I've never been an indiscriminate reader. I've never been that person who, quote, reads anything they can get their hands on.
Yeah.
Unquote. So, don't feel pressured into reading stuff you don't enjoy. Mm. Unless it's an assignment for school. But even then, there are limits. You know, don't feel like you have to read certain things, right? Mm-hmm. Read what you like. Try new things. Read things that are challenging, you know, like Robinson Crusoe.
Yeah.
But, you know, but that you enjoy. Mm-hmm. And so definitely read broadly, but don't feel like you have to read everything that is recommended. I mostly make my reading choices independently. I typically don't take recommendations, which is weird, I know. But, you know, you're going to find the stuff that you love to read. And if you find someone who makes recommendations that you like, take those recommendations for sure. Yeah. But yeah, don't feel like you have to like something just because somebody else said it's good.
Yeah.
Give things the benefit of the doubt, though. Revisit things later. You know, you reached some Shakespeare in high school. Like, we read Romeo and Juliet in ninth grade. I hated it. But then as an adult, I've gone back and revisited Shakespeare, and I really appreciate it now. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, wow, this is actually really good. I took a class on medieval literature in college and wasn't a huge fan of, say, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight and stuff like that. But I reread that story for some reason as an adult and found it really interesting. And that led me down this big path of reading medieval literature. I'm doing a Germanic studies master's degree right now and focusing on medieval German languages and literature because it's just fascinating stuff to me now. So, you know, it's kind of like your taste buds. Your taste in books might change a little bit over time. So don't be afraid to go back and revisit something you didn't like 10 years ago, you know. So those couple of things. And then finally, find people who will read your work, be honest with you, but in a positive, supportive way. Oh, and my last piece of advice, other than experiment broadly with your writing process till you find what works for you, my last piece of advice is take criticism with a grain of salt. Some people will critique a book, and this is why I made a general call for beta readers for The Red Door. I didn't have a set of beta readers for my work, and I wanted readers' perspectives who weren't me and weren't my relatives. And I had a bunch of you, and I found, okay, a couple of people sort of didn't get what I was trying to do with the story. So I can, unless they're saying I was confused by blah, 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 I can sort of discount their comments because they want me to be writing a story other, you know, a different story than what I'm writing. But the beta readers who understood what I was doing, I'm going to really pay attention to their feedback, especially if more than one of them makes the same type of comment. So you've got to learn to filter feedback and suggestions for changes to your writing in terms of, is this feedback going to help me write this story better? Or is this feedback telling me how they would write the story if they were the ones writing it? That you can say, that doesn't matter. It's the feedback that makes sense for the story you're telling that you really want to listen to and figure out if you want to apply that feedback, if that makes sense.
That is all very helpful advice. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sure a lot of young writers are going to benefit from your wisdom of having gone on before. And so we are so glad that they can hear your advice and then go read The Red Door and see how you have implemented it. I love the way you said that the ending slightly changed from beta to finished copy when you fleshed it out. And it was also so wonderful to see art added from the cover and to see that it really was what I was envisioning, which is always exciting to know that you aren't completely off base.
Oh, thank goodness.
Want to tell us anything about the illustration on the cover or the illustrator that you guys found?
Yeah, so the cover illustration is so cool. I really love it. Obviously, it features the Red Door and Aster coming through it. That I think always had to happen. There's also, it's really cool, there's also an Easter egg in the cover because I have an old charcoal drawing that I did of the Red Door in Afghanistan. And it's got this diamond pattern of sort of metal inlaid into this wooden door. And the cover designer, Oliver Allison, incorporated that into the door on the cover of the book, which I loved to see. Yeah, it was really cool.
That's awesome. One, that you had made that drawing, and two, that he was able to incorporate it in. Another thing that he incorporated into the cover that I really liked was the security cameras that you can almost miss, but they're at the very top. And I think it just adds to the ominous feel. this is not a nice little red door that she is coming through. This is more of a, you are being surveilled and your life choices may or may not be your own. And I thought that was just this little detail that really brought a lot of the story into focus in the cover.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not always a terribly visual thinker. In fact, one of the things that I have to be conscious of while I'm drafting and editing is to make sure that there's good visual detail in the book when I go back through. So I, you know, have contemplated this idea of, you know, surveillance in the town and so forth, but I never thought to represent it through actual surveillance cameras. So when I saw those on the cover, I was like, oh, what's that? Oh, yeah, that works. That makes it awesome. So it was kind of a surprise to me, even though I was like, oh, yeah, I mentioned surveillance a ton in the book. So that was really nice to see. And I was like, yeah, that works. That's a nice, like you said, it's subtle. They're at the edges of the cover. So it's not like it's taking over that central image of the door, but it works really well to sort of suggest a tone, which is really so great.
Yeah, it definitely hit the mark. I love it when a cover really brings the story to life before you've even cracked it.
So yeah, they did a nice job.
Fantastic. So something we focused on a lot on the podcast last year was wintering and going through wintering seasons and just seasons of hardship. And as a lot of people know, Amanda isn't hosting this year with me. She had stepped back because she thought she was going to be doing a lot more trips to take care of her mom. And then very sadly, her mom ended up passing in January. So Amanda is very much in a wintering stage right now. Mm-hmm. And so we did an episode. Our last episode last year was on self-care in a wintering season. And I just think that there's so much benefit to hearing other people's experiences going through wintering seasons and knowing that we aren't alone, because no one's going to get through this life without a wintering season.
Oh, yeah.
At least once.
Several.
Yes. Yes. Very likely. And so I was wondering if you had any personal experiences or advice for what you've done for self-care that maybe just I eat chocolate once a day and that's, you know, the thing I look forward to all day. That's totally fine. Everyone knows that I get my hair professionally washed when I feel like I'm drowning because I just cannot fathom the energy and mental energy it would take to do it myself. So what has worked for you that might encourage someone else or give them an idea for themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So it kind of depends, but I think the main things that I do, like if I'm in a tough season internally, then I definitely know I really need to be in a lot more prayer and Bible reading and just searching for the root questions, like what's really going on here. But in terms of sort of a concrete action, especially if it's just something more external or whatever, one thing that I find very helpful is to go back and reread a book that I have that I really enjoy that's not terribly challenging. So I might reread the first few novels in the Ranger's Apprentice series, for example, by John Flanagan.
Yeah.
Or I might reread The Good Master by Kate Sarity, or, you know, something like that, just something that I know really well that's not like Lord of the Rings, where it takes a lot of cognitive, you know, interaction. But that's just a good solid story that I like. And I find that's really helpful. I have loved rereading books for many, many, many years. I reread books all the time. I think that arose from the fact that I didn't really like the library, which I know is a very controversial thing to say. I have a much better appreciation for libraries now. But as a kid, like if you don't own the book, like what's the point? You know? But you know, one's parents might have limited funds. And so you might get to go to the bookstore and pick out a few books, but then you're going to have to wait a while before you do that again. And so when you're tearing through books at the rate I was, like in middle school and high school, you end up rereading a lot of stuff because you don't have maybe a steady fresh supply of new stuff always.
Right.
And so that's kind of a big comfort action for me, is rereading something that I really love.
Yes, that's beautiful. I love how your rereads have that adventure element that you were saying that you really like.
Yeah.
And for me, when I have babies, you kind of just are like bed and couch ridden for a while when you have a new nursling. And so I read through all of Jane Austen's books. And so I've done that every time since I had my second. And they're just, there's no action. So I know it's not going to get my adrenaline up when I'm just trying to keep myself awake in the middle of the night, but I want to go to sleep as soon as I can. And they're a story I know, like they're old friends. So it is like visiting an old friend, which can be very refreshing and encouraging.
Yeah, definitely. Well,
thank you so much for sharing that with us, Rachel.
Yeah, of course.
And thank you for coming and talking to us about The Red Door and talking to us about the writing experience. And I believe your trilogy that you wrote is about Civil Air Patrol. Is that correct? Or influenced by Civil Air Patrol?
No. So the trilogy that I wrote is a near future space adventure. And it's technically written for an adult audience, but it's clean. I know a couple of 10 and 11 year olds who have read it. What I'm working on next is a series of books inspired by my experiences volunteering with Civil Air Patrol. And it's going to feature Civil Air Patrol cadets, you know, just doing their thing and learning and having adventures, of course, and all of that good stuff. So that's the next series that I'm working on. Yeah.
Very cool. Inara is a staff sergeant in Civil Air really? Patrol. And so I heard something about one of your books being about the Civil Air Patrol. And I was like, I want to read that.
Oh, that's incredible. Good for her.
Yeah.
Wow.
It has been everything for her. She, when she was younger, she had an anxiety disorder that included selective mutism. Oh. And then in 2020, she was really struggling. We had had the fire. We were in a rental house. And I just remember that she was talking about how she wanted to get married someday, but she did not want to have people at the wedding she didn't know. And I was like, you can always elope. Like, there are options around this. But she was like talking about how she didn't want to talk to people. And she just didn't want to do things that involved mm-hmm. talking to people. And I felt, you know, the angle we had always taken before was to encourage her to try, to encourage mm-hmm. her to step outside, to encourage her to push herself and do these things. And I felt like it was just putting her more inside herself. Mm. And so I just felt the Holy Spirit tell me that she didn't have to. Mm-hmm. And so I told her that. And I was just like, Inara, you do not, if there's one thing that the shutdowns from COVID have taught us, it is that you do not have to interact with another human being and you can still live your life.
Yeah.
And so if you want to live the rest of your life in our basement and order your food on, you know, Food Grub and just mm-hmm. walk in and grab it and not have to talk to employees and have your groceries ordered and all this, like, as long as you are being productive with your life, mm-hmm. you can live with us in the basement and never talk to anyone outside the family again for the rest of your life.
Mm. And she was just gave her that, like, security.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that's what it was, but she just kind of sat there like this information just like smacked her upside the head. And she was just like, really? And I was like, really? And she was like, oh, okay. And so she walked out of the room. And then 2 days later, she just walked up to me and gave me this huge hug. Aww. And she was like, Mom, thank you for telling me that I didn't have to, because now I feel like I can if I want to.
Wow.
And she overnight was a different person, because wow. the morning after that hug, we stopped at a restaurant, just the two of us on our way home from Costco, and she turned to the waitress and ordered her own pancakes. She hadn't done that since she was six. And I was just like, whoa, what just happened, girl? And she's like, I just thought maybe I'd try it. And I was like, okay. And so the next week, I enlisted her in Civil Air Patrol.
Nice.
we went to a picnic. We saw that there were other girls in the squadron. And I was like, let's do it. And every week that we went, she was like, I'm not going to promote. I'm not going to do XYZ where I have to be in leadership. And I'm like, you don't have to. You just have to show up this week. Yeah. And she kept promoting and she kept doing the next step. Nice. And now she's a staff sergeant. Now she's in charge of a squadron.
Yeah.
Now she has strong opinions on other people's communication styles and how they're lacking. And she's just like That's this hilarious. Mother hen. And I love it. So Civil Air Patrol did so much for us as a family in helping her get air under her wings when she decided to try them.
And nice so thematic I'm metaphor.
Really what?
Nice on theme metaphor.
Okay. Yeah, right, air under trying. Her wings.
That's oh amazing. Goodness. So it was a great organization. Yes. I work with cadets in my volunteer position with them. I'm my squadron's deputy commander for cadets. So all I do, well, mostly all I do. Is work with cadets and mentor the more senior cadets. And we have a cadet in our squadron who was incredibly shy, you know, could not hardly put two words together up in front of the group. And now she's one of our flight leaders. You know, she's constantly giving, you know, orders for drill, and she gets up and leads activities and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So that's great to hear that story. That's even more amazing. But kids will surprise you, you know, if you say, hey, here's an opportunity to try some stuff that might be scary, but fun.
Yeah. But I think it comes back to that theme in The Red Door, right? Of security.
Yeah.
Of being known for who you are and loved anyway.
Yeah.
So we were knowing her for her lack of desire
to
go outside and talk to strangers.
Yeah,
and we told her that's okay. We still love you.
Yeah.
We love you despite that. Like, it doesn't matter if you ever talk to another human being, your love in our home is secure.
Yeah.
And
that freed her up.
That freed her.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So thank you so much for your time, Rachel. And I look forward to having you back when you've written your Civil Air Patrol books. And maybe we can convince Inara to come and sit in on that conversation.
That would be really cool. Yeah, that would be really cool. I'd love it.
To all of our listeners, you can order The Red Door right now. Pre-order it on Bandersnatch or the Kindle on Amazon. And Rachel's other self-published books that she's mentioned will also be in the show notes, and those can be found on Amazon right now. And we look forward to new offerings from her in the near future. And if you are looking for a literary database full of good book recommendations, you can find that on Reshelving Alexandria's website. And remember, the stories are truer than true.